This is the second episode in a three-part series. Please, listen to part one before continuing with this one. This series contains discussion of violence and crime scenes. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line.
Geraldine, I call her Hootie. I never call her Geraldine. She was so in love with her daughter, man. And she loved Victoria more than life itself. She thought the world of her. That was a nice coupling. You know, I was glad about it.
Last time, we began on May 28th, 1991, a hot and humid Tuesday, just after Memorial Day, in the tiny southeast Georgia town of Register. It was the day the body of a woman, Geraldine DeLoach, was discovered, laying between her new home and the local post office, covered in a blanket. She hadn't shown up for work that day at Georgia Southern University, where she was employed as a senior secretary. She'd spent the weekend moving into a new apartment, a converted meat locker with living quarters in the back and a storefront facing the street. Geraldine and her sister, Ava, they'd hoped to use that space for their social club's good works, like a volunteer childcare for single mothers. Geraldine's own child, Victoria, had been with Ava the evening before, while Geraldine and a local high school student worked on moving Geraldine's things to the new place. Victoria wasn't there that night or that morning when Geraldine didn't show up for work in Statesboro, when the new Jeep she'd just learned how to drive was spotted 10 miles away. At an apartment complex that she hadn't lived in months. But Victoria was in her Aunt Ava's car on the afternoon of May 28, 1991, when they drove into Register to see about Geraldine and to pick up some of Victoria's things. Ava was the one to discover her sister's body. She was the one, with Victoria in the car, to speed towards a local gas station and scream for help. Things had been going well for Geraldine DeLoach. After college, she'd moved back to Statesboro, the area near her tiny hometown of Register, and plenty of her family were still in town, even with brothers and sisters off at school or in the military. With 11 kids in the family, there was a lot of company and support to go around. She had plenty of friends too, like her sister-in-law Kim and her friend Athia from college. But there was stress, too. Her relationship with Victoria's dad hadn't worked out. She'd been raising Victoria on her own, and she had some issues getting child support for her daughter. There had even been a court date that same spring of 1991 concerning unpaid support. Help or no help, though, she was determined to give Victoria the best she could. Her friend, Athia, remembered Geraldine after Victoria's birth, and their early years together.
She was an awesome mom. You know, she buckled down, you know, because she had a child to take care of as far as working, making sure she had what she needed. I didn't witness any issues or, you know, any like, you know, I'm a single mom and, you know, what I'm going to do, oh, woe me. But no, she took it and she ran with it and she gave Victoria everything that she didn't have. And that's what we as parents, you know, want for our children. I just know that when she was murdered, you know, they were saying that she fought hard because probably in the back of her mind, she was thinking, you know, who's going to take care of my child if something happened to me? And that's every parent. But, you know, she had a loving family. She had a close-knit family, all of them together. They were very close. And I'm pretty sure she was thinking, you know, if something happened, then Victoria, she's going to be taken care of. So she was an awesome mom. She did whatever she had to do to make sure her child was okay.
That's how so many interviews about Geraldine went. Stories of the past mingled with what happened that day in May of 1991. It seems hard for people to separate the Geraldine that they knew and loved from the terrible crime, or maybe just to make sense of it. In February of 1991, Geraldine and her sister, Ava, began doing faith-based community service work in a more organized fashion. Ava, back in town while her husband was deployed, wanted to help people like Geraldine did, but they weren't just stopping and dropping off some coats or meals. They wanted to give women around their age something to do and a way to serve the area. Ava spoke to us about those plans.
We were just looking at the condition of the community, the condition of the people. And so Gerald and I, we just got into a conversation about what it was that we could do. And we just started, you know, just started putting our ideas together. And we reached out to other church members, and she reached out to a young lady she worked with. We first came up with it. We wanted to come up with the name. And we came up with the name of 2530 Social, because that was the, we were looking at the age group, that age group, because we were like, that was our age, some of our ages. And for that age group, there just wasn't a lot. There wasn't a whole lot to do in Bullock County. If you didn't go to college, what was there for you to do? And so we just brainstorming, what is it we can offer? What can we do for this community? And we were, and because Jody was a single mom, we wanted to, she know what it was like, what that struggle was like. And so we were thinking of, we were being very practical. We wanted to teach young girls how to know how to change your tires, show them how to, check your oil, just basic things like that. And give Spanish classes or just help in any way. Go into the community, do whatever we could do at the nursing home during those holidays where those folks might feel alone. We had a lot of great plans, and we created that organization in February. And you know, Geraldine, she was a great writer and very creative, a great thinker. And she started the newsletter. And it's a newsletter where, you know, you're going to mention what was going on in the church, if there were some family reunions going on or coming up that had something going on. It was a community type service organization. So you wanted to get the community involved. And so she created that newsletter. And as far as giving the news, we got the newsletter out, you just basically, when she typed it up, she just made a few copies and just gave them to us. And you give it to those, whether it was your family members, whether it was your church member, whether it was someone you work with. That's what we did. We just wanted to help. We just wanted to help do what we could, do our little part to get back to the community. Geraldine was excited. She could get a little frustrated too, because we just came up knowing, because we know how we were raised up, not having a whole lot, but having what we needed. And you just have that, you just want to do for others. You just want to help people. You just want to help to better somebody's life. So I'm thankful to God for that. We do our little part to contribute to and wherever we can. In her process of deciding to move, when we saw we saw the building was available. So we found out who it belonged to and to see if it was available that we could, because the front part of that little building is like a storefront. So we could use that for the organization and for the organization meeting. But the back part of that building had a little studio apartment. So we were like, two and two together. It's like, wow. She said, I guess she could live there and we can meet here and we could do what we needed to do to help the community.
So Geraldine was set to move. She'd first been in the Fox Ridge Apartments in Statesboro. Then she'd moved to Lord's Apartments Complex for a few months. Though she'd moved around a fair amount in the last year or so of her life, no one reported any major issues or problems that Geraldine seemed to be having, other than dealing with those child support issues. She was in a long-distance relationship with her boyfriend Dallas, who was in South Carolina, and she had her friends, her social club, and plenty of contact with her family. As far as anyone could tell, there weren't any signs that Geraldine was having any other troubles. Kim, the mother of Geraldine's niece, Yanisha, was also a close friend. Before Victoria was born, when Geraldine was working at a Shoney's near Kim's house, she'd come over and visit the family and would take all of Kim's kids, older boys included, out to eat. Geraldine would also invite them all to Deloach family reunions. As Kim told us, she treated every one of them like family, though only Yanisha was the daughter of her brother Ray. Once Victoria was born and Geraldine had been working at Georgia Southern for a while, she was living in that apartment complex called Fox Ridge. Kim said they still socialized frequently and that she couldn't imagine who would want to hurt Geraldine. It was hard to fathom that anyone could have, even after she got the news.
I know when she lived in Fox Ridge, and I used to go visit, and you know how when you got the little peephole on the door, I used to mess with it. I'd go and put my finger over that peephole and wouldn't let her see who was standing outside the door. But she would never open that door. And then when I moved my finger, I'm like, girl, it's me. Oh, girl, because I wasn't going to open that door. I couldn't see who was out there. So I never took anything from that. And at the time, I found out that afternoon what had happened, but that morning, one of my twins had an appointment. He had to have surgery on his ears, and we went through the way by Fox Ridge, which I knew she had moved, but the building she used to live in, I want to say was building 6 with the back turned towards the road, but her Jeep was there. And with me, what I was looking at, I knew she hadn't, been too long or moved out of there. I thought either she went back to get something or she went back to visit a neighbor. But that's where they found her Jeep at. But I saw her Jeep there that morning, but I don't know what happened. And like I was telling the sheriff back then, I wish I knew. But as to say, she was just taken so quick. She had just learned how to drive that stick. That was her Jeep. This was going back to Georgia Southern. She said when she was working out there before this happened, somebody had stole her purse and got all her information from there, her checkbook and all. And I don't know if they ever recovered that or whatever, but I'm saying it goes back to then. But who would want to harm her, I have no idea. None.
The last 2 days of Geraldine Deloach's life are well documented by the GBI. At least, as far as we know, based on witness reports. She'd planned to spend Memorial Day weekend moving the last of her things into her new place, but she knew she'd need help. According to GBI files, she stopped at her cousin's apartment that weekend to see if the cousin's husband, the same man who taught her to drive her Jeep, would help her move. But he wasn't home. So Geraldine called up a local high school student that she knew. Apparently, she was friendly with a number of teenagers in the area, most likely through church or mutual friends. This particular young man was one of them. A high school athlete, he was 18 in 1991 and a senior. Since he was still in school, we'll use a pseudonym for him, James. James agreed to help Geraldine gather her things. According to his interviews with local law enforcement, they spent 2 days, Sunday, May 26th, and Monday, the 27th, Memorial Day, collecting her belongings. In the recent past, Geraldine had lived at those three locations, Fox Ridge, the campus of Georgia Southern, and Lord's Apartments. It was to the last, Lord's, that they were headed. James told law enforcement that he and Geraldine had carried loads back and forth to the new place, then stopped in at a local laundromat to wash clothes that had been in storage. Apparently, the clothes had been damaged by mildew. An old neighbor of Geraldine's actually reported seeing her at the laundromat that day with a young man. She didn't know James. So that portion of the day seems to be verified by multiple sources. James told the officers that on Sunday, they also washed her new Jeep and Geraldine took him out to eat. Her treat, she said, for the help. They went to a popular local spot, Captain Joe's, for fried shrimp, hush puppies, and fries. And afterward, when Geraldine dropped him off, she briefly spoke with his mother. That was around 6 p.m. Geraldine was headed to church. James promised to help her on Monday, and she said she'd pick him up around 4:30. The 27th would be the last day Geraldine's family saw her alive or spoke to her. James told police that it was the last time he saw her, too. His story was that they got right to work, loading her Jeep and driving out to register, where they stacked boxes in a corner of the new apartment. They managed two loads back and forth in the evening heat. They had to stop at a local gas station for a Diet Coke and an orange soda because there wasn't anything to drink at the new place. And then, when they were on their way to register with the third load, it began to storm. It was a serious downpour. Rain hitting the road so hard and fast that Geraldine and her Jeep would have been swamped. They were stranded at the new place, at least until the storm let up. So, James called his mother to let her know they'd be late. It was about 8 p.m. then. Geraldine's TV was already set up at that point, so they watched a few shows. James told detectives that they watched the shows from about 8 until 10 when Geraldine got a phone call from her boyfriend in South Carolina, a conversation that James described as a good one. But he also said there was some disagreement over Geraldine's daughter, Victoria, but not in the way that one might imagine. According to James, Geraldine's out-of-state boyfriend was telling her not to worry about missing the child support from Victoria's father. He said that he would take care of the three-year-old. According to James, Geraldine, a little irritated, said she could support her daughter on her own. When authorities later spoke to Geraldine's boyfriend, he repeated the same basic information about the phone call. Like James, he said it lasted about 15 minutes. Though Geraldine's boyfriend was interviewed on several occasions to gather information, he was never considered a person of interest in the case. Not only did he and Geraldine have plans to marry, he was incarcerated in South Carolina at the time of her death and could not have been in Georgia that May. After that phone call, James reported that Geraldine spoke with her sister, Ava. Geraldine's daughter, Victoria, was over at Ava's place, and they discussed the upcoming wedding of their younger brother, Rayford, and what Victoria would wear as a flower girl. They also made plans for Ava to pick up Victoria's hair accessories. Again, Ava was able to verify this conversation. James said that, at that point, he excused himself and went to the bathroom. When he returned, Geraldine was on the phone again. He told investigators that he only heard one short bit of the conversation. Her saying something along the lines of, "I'll get your money." He said he didn't know whom she was speaking to, and he didn't ask. Then, James said she turned to him and said, "I guess I'd better take you home now." He told investigators that they got in her Jeep, and she drove him back to Statesboro. James reported that Geraldine was quiet on the way back into town. Specifically, he said that she, quote, looked depressed. But he also remembered that she'd said she had a toothache, so that could explain both. Geraldine asked James if he'd help her again after school the next day, and he agreed. The plan was for her to call up the high school and leave a message. He told investigators that he knew he arrived home at about 11:55 p.m. because he looked at the clock when he walked inside. As he told investigators, James never got that message at school. He said he figured that Geraldine had decided not to move anything that day. So he stayed after school to practice in the gym for a while, and then he headed over to a friend's house. James didn't hear about Geraldine's murder until Tuesday evening, when a friend called and asked if he'd heard the news. Then, the other phone calls began. No one is sure what happened that night, Monday, May 27th, 1991. There are some neighbors who were able to offer pieces of information that, added up, could help begin to unpack what happened between midnight, when James says Geraldine dropped him off, and the next afternoon, when her body was discovered. One neighbor reported hearing multiple car horn beeps in the early hours of the morning. This resident lived across the road and said someone had actually pulled into his yard at one point. The horn blast came about 15 minutes apart, and they woke him up. It was not usual activity for that area out in the country. He wasn't sure if it was someone trying to wake him, but he told investigators that, if that was the case, they'd eventually knock on his door. He estimated by the sound of the horn that it was a small vehicle, but he never did look out the window. He wasn't sure what time of night this occurred. If you'll recall from the last episode, Geraldine's Jeep had been spotted early Tuesday morning at her old apartment complex by her cousin. That cousin had called Ava, who checked on Geraldine at work. But due to a miscommunication, Ava thought that Geraldine had just stepped out of the office, not that she was actually out of the office. She had no idea that her sister hadn't arrived at work that day. Ava had Victoria with her, and she was focused on caring for the toddler. She wasn't prepared for what happened, but no one could have been.
It was hot and humid that day. So we, you know, your energy level is kind of zapped. Although I didn't have that hair bag, I went ahead and I did her hair. You know, you get up in the morning, you get your child dressed and you know, you do what you have to do. I said, I can figure out how to do your hair. Use what I already have and make do. I don't have the time, but I know I got a call from a family member about seeing Geraldine's vehicle somewhere. And for me, because Geraldine had already told me that her supervisor had gotten on to her about getting too many personal calls. So when my cousin called about having seen Geraldine's car, I was like, okay, you saw her car. All right. And then I said, well, now, that's when I just said, well, I'll drive to the back of her building. And her apartment building was next to the little registered post office. Right off of Highway 46 and Register. So I drove back there, and Victoria's in the car with me. And there, I just and she had borrowed a blanket from me days prior. So when I drove back there, that's when I see the object there, and it with my blanket. And I just I think I remember what I do recall is seeing like a hand. And I don't, and I just, after that, everything just kind of, I think everything just got kind of crazy after that. I think I lost a lot of time. A lot of that time, I don't remember. And I tell people now, God had to be carrying me because I don't even know how I would have gotten through that. We were just so close, and you just don't ever think something like this would happen in the little town you were raised up in. And so it was, I think I just went into shock. But one thing I knew, though, I had to do was to take care of Victoria. She was my priority. Though she was there with me, and she probably didn't know what was going on. She probably didn't know why I was reacting the way I was and asking people for help, asking people to go to the building and check. When I had to go back over there, I remember sitting in the car. I remember, and they were questioning me about, you know, what happened. Me seeing her body. I never got out of the car. So I never, it's just what I saw. And then I saw like a hand peering out. That's what was in my memory. And so when I went back to the scene from that store, I don't even know how I got back to the store. I guess someone would have driven me back over there because it would have already have been turning dark. But I remember looking over there and I saw, and maybe they would have told me then. I don't know. But I remember seeing that object, which was her, still on the ground. And I remember asking, why was she still there on the ground? And then I think, I don't remember his answer, but I think he tried to just get me off of that subject. So I know I ended up in the emergency room later on that next day or that early morning. I think I was just in shock. I couldn't eat for days. I could not eat for days. I didn't eat for days until my husband got back from overseas, from Iraq. And I remember my Aunt Alice kept telling me, she said, baby, you got to eat something.
An extended family member, a father-in-law to one of Ava and Geraldine's brothers, was actually at the gas station when Ava pulled up. He reported that she was screaming, calling over and over for help for her sister. Someone needed to see to Geraldine. Once the Bullock County Sheriff's officers arrived on scene, we know several things occurred. Sketches were made, photographs were taken, and the apartment was fumed with superglue before any of the searchers could contribute their own fingerprints. This is a fairly common method of fingerprint collection. That would lead to a number of notations in the file of fingerprints being taken on various members of Geraldine's family and of her known associates, so that they could be eliminated as having contributed to the scene. Though the GBI were not yet involved in the case, they soon would be. Our best source for up-to-date knowledge today is the current case agent, Maddie Vogelsang. She walked us through the scene of the crime.
Geraldine Dilich was found in May of 1991. She was found outside of her house on the grass by her porch, and she was dressed only in underwear, a t-shirt, and she was covered in a blanket, and her door was locked. The kitchen was in disarray, possibly because at the time Geraldine was moving from an apartment in Statesboro to an apartment in Register, which is about a 10-minute, 15-minute drive. When the agents entered the apartment, there was a lot of kind of random things scattered on the floor. There was trash and laundry, and there was a lot of blood on the floor.
The GBI files contain Bullock County's early reports, listing each item from Victoria's Barbie doll lying in a corner to the drink bottles James and Geraldine had earlier in the day. Though, according to James and Geraldine had no alcohol that evening, her tox screen would later show a low level of alcohol. Geraldine had never been much of a drinker. Her friends all agreed that, at most, she would have a wine cooler at a gathering and usually didn't buy more than one at a time. If she had one that night, it could have been later, either alone or with someone else who came to the house after James was gone. Now, Agent Vogelsang continues her explanation of the crime scene.
On the ground of the kitchen was block lettering that was written in a substance that was found in the home, and the lettering essentially blamed a certain person for killing Geraldine. The writing was about the size of a post-it note. It was kind of messily scrawled, so between the disarray in the kitchen, and then on the outside porch, there are a couple of flower pots, and Geraldine was found in the grass off of the porch.
This word, scrawled on the ground of the kitchen floor, would seem to be an obvious clue. But though it did offer a name, investigators did not believe Geraldine had left this information for them to try and point to her killer. Rather, they believe that, after the fact, her murderer or murderers had created the message to try and cover their tracks and, perhaps, point towards someone else. For obvious reasons, that name can't be released here, but investigators did look into that lead, both in 1991 and in later cold case reviews. As Agent Vogelsang mentioned, Geraldine was found outside, near the porch, and she was covered in Ava's blanket, whether to protect the eyes of those who found her, or as a sign of regret on the killer's part, we don't know. Maybe it was both. Maybe neither of those things. A profile from the GBI would later suggest that Geraldine was killed by someone she was familiar with, and her family thought this was likely, mostly because she was a cautious person. She wouldn't have been out late at night by herself, or opened the door to a stranger. The profilers believe that the blanket was a sign that the murderer, and they discussed a single person, felt shame or sorrow for their actions, and then covered her. Then again, it could be the action of someone who knew that Geraldine had a child, one who could be home at any time, and didn't want Victoria to see her mother. It appeared that someone had used the blanket, the one used to cover Geraldine, to assist in moving or dragging her body across the yard. If that was true, then the blanket was already part of the crime scene. The killer could have chosen to leave it on the ground. But instead, they used it to cover Geraldine. There was another unusual aspect to the scene. Agent Vogelsang explained during our interview in late 2020.
When investigators got to the scene, they had to break down the door because the door had been locked from the outside with a key. And additionally, it was later found that Geraldine had been dead for approximately 12 to 24 hours before she was found. And just a few hours before she was found, multiple people in the area had walked by that area and hadn't seen her and said that they, you know, looked right where she was found and would have seen her. So we believe that she was killed in the house and was later moved outside.
The locking of the door. There's no way to know what the goal was there, except that the murderer took Geraldine's keys earlier in the day and left her body in the home while her Jeep was moved to the Fox Ridge apartment complex. That tracks with what we know about the events of Tuesday outside of Geraldine's apartment. We know that in the morning, the local postmaster was at work and was in view of Geraldine's apartment at least twice before 2 p.m. that day. He reported to police that he came outside and saw construction going on near her place, specifically a backhoe and other heavy equipment moving back and forth, and did not see her Jeep. And he was positive that he did not see Geraldine's body. When investigators spoke to the construction crew, the driver of the backhoe was able to give an estimate as to the last time he'd driven his equipment through that area, about 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday. He hadn't seen anything on the ground at that time. That means that sometime between the activity at the construction site and the post office and Ava's late afternoon arrival, Geraldine's body appeared in the grass side yard next to her apartment. It's unlikely that she would have been taken to another location and then brought back to her apartment. And because the Jeep was still at Fox Ridge, the murderer or murderers, or perhaps accomplice after the fact, would have had to return later in the day to place her outside the home, lock the house again, and leave. The question is, why? Was there something left at the scene that needed to be retrieved? Was there some reason that they wanted Geraldine to be discovered on Tuesday and outside? And finally, why relock the door when they left? The evidence from Geraldine's apartment was collected. This included a number of prints, as well as blood samples, personal items, and photographs. Geraldine's Jeep was also searched and fumed with superglue for fingerprints. Geraldine's autopsy was performed by the local coroner. She suffered extensive and extremely brutal injuries, several of which contributed to her death. Per the GBI's request, we won't go into more detail here. She was only 27 years old when she died. Her daughter, Victoria, was just a month away from her fourth birthday. We've spoken to many of Geraldine's friends and family about that Tuesday in May when they got a call about her death. Her mother, May Knight, was living close by at the time.
I couldn't believe it. My mom was the one that called me, told me that something had happened to Geraldine. I said, what, you know? And she said, she's dead. And I said, a heart attack. Yeah, I don't know. But I went out there and I just couldn't believe it. I think I broke to jump out the car and go begin running towards the body and running across where they had the tape up. And so I think some of the officers would go out and stop me, you know, but I had already lifted up the tape to go under there. But some of the officers would stop me.
You just wanted to get to her?
Yes. And then one of the amazing things, she was covered with the blanket. Whoever did it, they took time to cover her up. Whether it was disguised, well, it was a body, or whether it was carried and had her wrapped up and had to drop her because of some unpassing, or just what. And I just couldn't understand why she would lay out there all that time until that evening, 4 or 5 o'clock, and no one noticed this buck out there on the side of the, whether the post office right there. People going to the post office. Why did someone glance over and see this? Just see something over there that maybe looked unusual, but it didn't happen. It was just, but I guess that's what it was just intended for it to be that way. But it's hard. It really is.
Geraldine's sister Marie was in Atlanta in 1991. She told us about getting the news of her sister's death.
Yeah, I do remember getting the call. I do. And, the biggest concern I had at that time, it was just, I was 6 months pregnant. So I was, almost 7 months. I think June, July, September, because my second son was born in September, and this occurred in June. So, it was just totally shocking. So totally, just being totally shocking, unbelievable. Just couldn't imagine why this would be happening to her. You know, just almost unbelievable. Small town, happy-go-lucky person, as far as I'm concerned. Just totally shocked, totally, totally shocked. And then to find out how it happened, it just became more unreal. At the time I was still married, of course, and of course my husband would not allow me to, to drive the distance or to get down there like I really truly wanted to. So I was kind of delayed and getting down there and trying to figure out exactly what was going on. So, it was just totally shocked and more shocking to know, some of the details as to where she was found and how long she'd been where she was and the fact that she was left the way she was, that kind of thing was just more shocking to unbelievable. Just sent out lots of red flags as to, she was moving into a new place and maybe thinking that maybe there was some resentment towards her moving into that place, the people happen to move. Just, your mind just was just going to who and why and, what could we do, that kind of. Just unbelievable. Totally shocked. Concerned about Victoria. When I got the phone call, I didn't know that Victoria wasn't actually home that night. Ava had taken her, which was a good thing in the fact that she was not there.
Ava, who discovered Geraldine, still has trouble sorting through her memories and feelings of that day. She thinks that everyone in her family probably does. It makes sense. They suffered a collective trauma rippling across phone lines, house to house, city to city, state to state. The ones that could they came right away. The ones that couldn't, they had to wait for news.
It was just strange, now that I think about it, how, wow, I think I must have been walking just through this, felt like I was just in some kind of, it felt like you really, just really in this nightmare or dream, and you just want to wake up from it. Because nothing really seemed real. So I think I was really, probably now that I'm older now and I can look back on things, and I was probably pretty traumatized. But I functioned, and thank God I functioned, because having Victoria there, I knew I had to. I knew I had to take care of her. I knew that's what Geraldine would have wanted, is for me to take care and look after Victoria. And that's what I did. And having my family and my faith in God and people that were in my life, my friends, that's how I got through a lot of aspects of things that went on, because, you know, there were a lot of moving parts, because if there's an investigation going on, then you got to plan the funeral, and you're trying to deal with your emotions at the same time. You're trying to take care, protect, provide, and secure your niece and each one of my siblings. I'm sure they were just like me. They're in shock. Here it is, their sister, their beloved sister, is gone, and she's been murdered. So they're dealing with it too. So we're all dealing with this, and we're probably all dealing with it in our own way, and we're probably all in shock. And all of us probably then and now, we just want to know who and why. If someone could have answered those questions, who and why? Why? Geraldine was a loving person. Geraldine was a fun-loving person. Geraldine loved to laugh. Geraldine would do anything for anyone. She was not an aggressive person. She was not a hateful person. She could be the life of the party. Who and why? Why?
Geraldine's niece, Yanisha, was only a few years older than Victoria. She was supposed to go stay with her father, Ray, Geraldine's older brother, that Tuesday, but he never showed up to get her from her mother's house. Eventually, a phone call came, and then they knew why he hadn't shown. Something terrible had happened.
I remember they just being told that something's going on with my Aunt Hootie, and some detectives came to our house, because I guess they knew how close my mom and her was, and not knowing what had happened or who did it to my aunt, I guess they were saying that we had to be watched or something like that, because, yeah, just for safety reasons. So I remember that. And then I remember we would go outside and we might see like an unmarked car would be parked, you know, like maybe across the, in the woods, not in the woods, but like very close to where we lived at. After we found out she had been killed, and they, you know, of course they were saying they didn't know who did it, why. So of course I think I was scared too, because I know, like you say, they was watching, you know, telling us they didn't know who did it. And so we had to be watched, so that scared me up.
And that's the thing. In the midst of mourning for Geraldine, the bright and lovely sister, daughter, mother, there was also fear. No one knew who had killed her, or why, or if anyone else in the family was in danger. Her family was worried. If Geraldine's case would get attention, if her killer would be caught, if they would find out why. They had to hope, to believe that they would. After all, this was small-town Georgia. Then again, that can be its own problem. Yanisha's mother, Kim, reflected on that during her interview.
That little town of Register knew what happened. They know, because they found her body outside of her apartment. And you mean to tell me nobody saw nothing? People in and out that post office all day. So if that body had been out there all day, you mean to tell me you wouldn't have seen it wrapped up in that comfort laying out there? Somebody knows something in that area.
If you have any information regarding the murder of Geraldine Deloach, please call the GBI Region 5 office at 912-871-1121. Next time on The Fall Line, the final episode in our series on Geraldine Deloach, we cover the investigation, leads, and where the case stands today. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIAs, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support our show and stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We are raising Patreon funds to continue to fund the Milberg Twins billboard, begin a therapy fund for families who've been on the show, and many other projects. You can read a public post about those goals on our Patreon page. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kim Fritz, and Jessica Ann. Family and law enforcement interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced and engineered by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to the Black and Missing Foundation.